Vacations are always good. Sometimes they're even great. And Celebrity Cruises is about to ruin all of that. Because once you explore with us, you'll never want a vacation any other way. And with new quick Caribbean escapes, you'll never want a weekend any other way either. Celebrity Cruises. Nothing comes close. Visit celebrity.com, call 1-800-CELEBRITY, or contact your travel advisor. Ships Registry, Malta and Ecuador.
Some people like to deep clean every Saturday morning. I prefer to spend a few minutes every day keeping things fresh with Lysol. Lysol's brand new day all-purpose cleaner cleans and kills 99.9% of viruses and bacteria on hard, non-porous surfaces around your home with a fragrance that feels like a tropical getaway for your senses. Don't just clean, Lysol clean.
Emmy Award-winning John Mulaney presents Everybody's in L.A., a special run of six live episodes created by and starring Mulaney that'll stream live on Netflix during the Netflix is a Joke Fest. The comically unconventional show will feature special guests where John Mulaney explores the city of Los Angeles during a week when every funny person is in it. Watch John Mulaney Presents Everybody's in L.A., debuting May 3rd live at 7 p.m. Pacific Time, only on Netflix.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Have you ever spotted McDonald's hot, crispy fries right as they're being scooped into the carton? And time just stands still. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
Hey, do you want to be like me? Make podcasts that everyone loves? Yeah, you do. But chances are, you don't want to spend a bunch of money doing it. No worries. A solution exists. Spotify's got a platform that lets you make podcasts super easy, then distribute those podcasts everywhere, and you can even earn money doing it. All in one place for free. It's called Spotify for Podcasters, and here's how it works. Spotify for Podcasters lets you record and edit podcasts right from your phone or computer. So no matter what your setup is like, you can start creating today. Then you can distribute your podcast to Spotify and everywhere else podcasts are heard. Also, you can earn money in a variety of ways, including ads and podcast subscriptions. I'm speaking from experience when I say that all those additional features like video podcasts, Q&As, polls, those are things you won't find for cheap elsewhere. But with Spotify for Podcasters, it's all totally free, no catch. I highly recommend you give it a try. Download the Spotify for Podcasters app or go to www.spotify.com/podcasters to get started. Thanks. We love you.
Hey, everybody, welcome to Pretty Scary, I believe.
Yes, Pretty Scary. Oh, Boo. Pretty Scary Boo.
Are you Caitlin Cutt?
I am, actually. Yes.
Because I'm Adam Todd Brown. And that, it's to me, sounds like the hosts of Pretty Scary.
It sounds like that show. And it's nice to finally connect.
It really, you know, is. It's good to put a face to the name.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
It's after been a, it all these
never
years.
Happened. All these years.
Crazy.
Man, You look exactly the way I thought you would.
Same, same.
Yeah.
So do you.
So you just assumed I had flaming red hair?
I did.
Got it. Okay. Cool.
The nose ring connected to the earring with a chain is an interesting attempt to bring back a thing everyone hated the first time they saw it.
Yeah. And I've taped it to the side of my face so it doesn't ruin the recording. So that's what the painter's tape is.
So it's not jingling. It's not a tattoo. Jingling. It's
just correct.
If you ever know you're going to be in a fight, you're going to want to do that too. Otherwise,
that's what this latch is for. It's a release. It just pops right off. Well, I'm in a lot of street fights.
Who isn't? These days?
2021. Here we are.
Caitlin City. Yeah. How is it going?
Good. You know, I gotta say, right now, I'm okay. Nobody's sick. I'm okay right now. I'm doing all right.
Well, that's good to hear.
How are you?
Oh, you know, I'm fine. As fine as can be.
Same as it ever was.
You may ask yourself, what are we talking about today?
This is not my lower intestine.
These are not my beautiful poops.
These are not my creepy hemorrhoids.
That is a appropriately tasteful way to transition into what we're talking about today.
That song specifically, yeah, actually.
The whole thing. Because we're talking about some shit. And by that, I mean the curse of Von Dutch.
I just want to say at the top of this that I texted you. I always assumed this brand was vaguely racist, and I did not realize how right I was.
So right. Holy shit.
Had no idea.
I didn't either. I don't even remember that story breaking.
Because there was no social media.
Yeah. It was before
social
media.
So it's like that would have, okay, we'll get to it. But I just want to say that the people that I saw wearing that stuff were always the people I thought were neo-Nazis.
Yeah.
Always. Like it was a very specific, especially downtown Huntington Beach, late 90s, early 2000s, like, dude, there was an aesthetic that these got, like, very, like, rockabilly.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
/ neo-Nazi.
That's where started. And then it became every celebrity in the world, which we're going to get to all of that.
We're going to get to all of it.
We're covering, this is a documentary you can watch on Hulu called The Curse of Von Dutch. And then there's some other stuff after that.
I'm not going to. Yeah. I don't care about that part.
But it's a good documentary. It's only 3 episodes, which I appreciate. Each episode
that it's 3 episodes. Like, nothing needs to be more than that.
And each episode has a purpose. Like, there's not a lot of fat on this documentary, which I appreciate. Because this is the rare case where you do kind of need to know a lot of backstory. Man. Because otherwise, it's just a documentary about a murder that is clearly self-defense.
Yeah. I mean, I do want to say that it's very clear to me that, like, 2 of these major tentpole interviews must have been incredibly difficult to conduct. One, because one of them literally repeatedly gets up and walks around, which is like a nightmare if you're trying to film somebody.
He's very animated. Yeah.
Yeah. And then the other person is on crack. And that's not like me saying, like, Caitlin, they're on crack.
Caitlin, don't slander that man's good name. He is smoking pain pills.
Sure.
So,
my bad.
No, smoking pain pills is essentially smoking crack. Like,
Got it. I never think about.
I mean,
things.
They don't have the same effect, but he's essentially like doing opiates, but just
on camera.
In a more direct way than just popping a pill
in his trailer.
Yeah. The next step is injecting him.
Yeah, but, you know, he's just not going to do that on camera, I guess.
I don't doubt that he would shoot, I don't doubt that he would inject pain pills into his arm. Like, he's, for people at home who haven't seen it, he's got the pill crushed up on a piece of aluminum foil, and he's got a lighter under that and a straw that he's using to smoke it. Which if you know anything about meth, that usually goes from snorting it to smoking it to injecting it. Same with heroin. So he'll get there. Interview him in 10 years if he's alive.
Speaking of getting there, let's explain the documentary to people who have found this podcast and this is the first episode that we've ever listened to.
Well, this documentary, it's about Von Dutch, which was a huge clothing brand in the late 90s, early 2000s.
Yeah.
It eventually came to be known as Von Douche because the clientele it was attracting was not necessarily respected on the world stage, which brings us to just how damn appropriate is it that the theme song for this documentary is Butterfly by Crazy Town.
That is
Von Dutch trucker hat in song form.
That was such a win for that team. This team. I mean,
oh yes.
Right when it started, I went, uh-huh. Like, okay, cool. Like, so they already know. They've already dialed it all in. There's no...
It's a win for both sides.
Yeah.
Because everyone secretly loves that song, for one thing.
Yeah.
Like,
it's a good vibe.
No one doesn't like it, but the people who admit they like it are going to be hooked right away, and then they won't be as heartbroken when they find out the clothing brand they wore so much was for Nazis.
My relationship with that song is not unlike my relationship with Von Dutch, which is I've never sought it out intentionally. It's always literally right. just appeared in a room that I'm in or a place that I'm at. And I've never had like a virulent reaction to it. I've always been fine with it. But the second it's out of my purview, I never think about it ever, like at all. It has to literally appear to me completely embodied for me to even think about it.
Yeah, like if your favorite band is Crazy Town, you're a very specific kind of person. And you know there's crazy. People out there who are like, yeah, I'm sorry, Crazy Town is my favorite band. It's like, really? Out of all the bands?
I feel like sometimes people choose obscure things to make their thing because somehow they feel like they're going to eventually have access to that thing.
Either that or it gives them a sense of personality.
Anytime you're trying to achieve that externally, I don't know what to, you got a rough road ahead. Or like, I feel like an even weirder answer would be U2.
Mm-hmm.
Like that would be even further down whatever river we're navigating right now. Like, oh, like that's a very safe choice, I guess. Like,
yeah, if your favorite band is U2, you better have a family member who lost a leg in the Troubles. Like that.
Exactly.
Other than that, what is your desire?
I feel like I'd have more respect for somebody who said their favorite band was like still the Spice Girls.
Right. Yeah.
I'd be like, oh, okay. Well, that's a choice. Like you've done something there, and I guess I can't argue with their staying power. Crazy Town fans, tweet at us. Let us know that you exist.
Yeah, let us know how Shifty Shell Shock is doing.
Strong choice to open the documentary with. Could not. That's the perfect song. There is no better song. And it made me feel like, okay, these people have a command of the topic and this is going to be good. I immediately felt that way about it when that came on.
And that's correct. This is, I would say right up front, this is a good documentary. It's
it is
really well done. How much Von Dutch clothing did you have back in the day?
Zero.
Yeah, same. Because I lived in South Dakota. So by the time it even got to me, it got to me as, oh, look at the stuff that all the douchebags that you don't like wear. But also Tommy Lee, he's cool.
My problem is I look really bad in hats. And I know a lot of people are like, I don't look good in hats. They put a hat on. You're like, what are you talking about? Something about my head disappears if I wear it. It's very weird. I look very weird in a hat. So to me, the Von Dutch thing, it was mostly the hat because I thought the clothes were not for me. We'll just put it that way. Because it was like super hot girl shit also.
Yeah.
Where I was from and like very specific, like very thin, like very big boob hot girl shit. So it wasn't for me.
Yeah. It's just not the same if you're wearing that to your day job at Starbucks.
No, I worked at a gift shop called the General Store where we sold small ceramic angels. Like it wasn't.
Not a Von Dutch environment.
Yeah, they were like, you're hired. I was like, that's sad. I don't know what that means. We sold flags for every holiday.
Oof.
Yeah.
Any flag scares me these days.
Yeah, all flags are scary.
So the first episode is all about the controversy behind who actually founded Von Dutch, which is way more of a controversy than I ever realized.
Is it a controversy or is this just a collection of very disorganized, weird people?
Yeah, it's kind of that.
I think this documentary tries to position itself in some ways as like, isn't this a tragedy? And it's like, not really.
Yeah.
Because it's a string of people not reading their contract. It genuinely is that problem. It's that.
And like, I would argue they really telegraph who's going to die at the end. And the problem with the person who dies is he maybe had the least to do with the story. So at the end, it's kind of, it's like one of those like sitcom episodes where they would tease that someone's going to die. And then it ends up being like the landscaper who's been in five episodes. And it's like, oh, you're cheating. Kill the dad.
But
beyond that,
it didn't bother me.
Yeah.
It's just, it was also like the person that dies is kind of like a, well, yeah.
Yeah.
I hate to say this. It's like, you, okay, let's get into it.
We should mention Von Dutch is a real person. Guy named Kenneth Howard.
Boy, was he a real person.
He's a real person, if you know what I mean.
Like a very specific person. It's like if Walt Disney was a planner's wart, he would be this person.
But he's also just sort of connected to the Von Dutch clothing line in that it's his name and it's his art, but...
Oh, I was even going deeper. I was thinking, never mind, I see what you're saying. Yes, this guy, the guy in Long Beach.
What? No, I wasn't like contradicting what you said. I was just moving on with the notes.
Yeah, I was like, what?
Yeah, he's not... Like, it's his art, but he also had this very stupid, I would argue, personal... belief that copyrights and patents and things like that were overrated. So it seems like these people knew that and were just like, let's fucking start a clothing line and put all his shit on it.
I just have a hard time feeling. It was very odd to see all of these men spouting off their business philosophies from a trailer and what looks like an abandoned downtown LA warehouse. I don't think anybody should listen to you.
Yeah, it seemed like the only one who should be listened to on that front was Sony. Is that how you pronounced his name? Because it wasn't Sonny.
Wasn't Sonny, was it?
No, it was either Sony or Sony. Now I can't remember.
I think they said it once and everybody was like, let's not do that again.
Yeah, we're just going to go back to Sonny. It's fine.
Just let's stick with that.
Because that guy, they interviewed him in what appeared to be the room in his house where he stores his motorcycle collection. Like... And he came here as a Taekwondo master and a budding actor who did not work out as an actor. But
I respect the fact that he pivoted. I actually don't really have a total issue with this guy. I think they try to position him in some ways as like the villain. But
yeah,
I can't see that. Like,
I think he turns really out not to be. But he does do one thing early on that's kind of questionable. Also, his pivot, if you remember, they reveal it near the end. His pivot was he married a rich Brazilian woman. Like, he didn't work his way up from actor to billionaire investor. He just married a rich woman.
I think I just respect anybody who gives up on acting.
Yeah.
And that's genuinely like, I'm done and I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm like, mad respect.
And if you can,
I know so many like real estate agents / actors. It's just,
oh, for sure.
It's a lot to watch.
And if you can pull a rich Brazilian woman to the point that she wants to be your wife just on your Taekwondo skills, bravo. Bravo.
I would then argue there are more skills there than are being signaled, in my opinion. Yeah.
He can fuck. So. What?
What do you mean?
So eventually they turn his art into a clothing brand. And that's kind of the central controversy of this documentary, which is, or at least this episode, but kind of the whole documentary, which is who created Von Dutch? Because there are at least three people who claim to be the ones who started it. Four, if you count the Sonny guy, but he just laughs when they ask him if he created Von Dutch. The first guy they interview is Ed Boswell, who he's one of the people who claims to have founded the company. What I like about Ed Boswell, you've seen the first Purge movie, the one with Ethan Hawke, right?
Oh, yeah.
And you remember how that ends. Spoiler alert, everybody. There's the guy that they let into the house right in the beginning. And then for most of the movie, you never see him again. It's like you almost forget he exists, which is a classic horror movie thing. And then at the end, he just shows up again to save the day. Ed Boswell does that, and we'll get to how, but yeah. He actually shows up to ruin everyone's day.
Yeah,
at the end.
He's just that mole you never got checked out.
And he's got kind of a valid reason to do it.
Oh, I'd say more than kind of, but...
Because he really gets fucked out of this company worse than anyone else.
Yeah. Yes. I just, again, though, I really have a hard time. If your whole attitude is, I'm always a little conflicted when I interact with people that are like, hey, fuck the man. I'm going to start a small business. It's like, wait.
You kind of need the man for like, that.
You're going to need the man. The man's going to have to show up. Sometimes
I registered this company as an LLC, and now I have to tell California immediately whenever I move, like I'm on the fucking sex offender registry. It's crazy.
Yeah. You started a company. So it's like, that's what happens. And
can I tell you, people thinking of moving to California? I don't know if there is a more ruthless tax collecting agency on the planet than California state tax.
Oh no. Yeah, no.
They do not fuck around.
Uh-uh. No. No, they don't.
Anyway, that's a sidebar.
Okay. So this guy, you know, he was friends with the original Von Dutch guy.
Right.
And basically wanted to, even his, like, plan is murky to me, to be totally honest with you, Adam. I don't really know. And I don't think it's the documentary's fault. Like, sometimes I watch this, I'm like, you didn't get a good interview. But I think with this guy, I mean, it literally opens with him letting them into his Long Beach apartment and opting to lay on a bed for his interview.
Yeah, like he's doing psychotherapy.
And so his whole kind of like, he just seems like all of these men seem like impossible people to be around for extended periods of time.
Yes.
And I find it fascinating that they all gravitated towards this aesthetic, you know, it's weird because all of them on some level, like, would you just realize if you're a sane person that's trying to build a healthy life, oh, you're going to self-destruct. There's no, you know, and this guy clearly, he does it early on by showing up at a trade show and having his little patches everywhere. And then basically lets these guys walk away with the patches.
Yeah. He, like, in that way, he did create Von Dutch.
Yes, because he literally designed the patch that everybody thinks, like, if you say Von Dutch, the thing that you're seeing in your head, that's, he made that
patch. Yeah.
Because even Von Dutch didn't make that.
And exactly.
He was like a weird surfer artist, like surrealist guy. It's very weird.
Yeah, he was known for pinstriping. That was like his thing.
Yeah, the hill he died on. Well, no, not
well,
yet.
Well, no. He died on a very, very different hill.
Specific hill.
What was up with where this guy lived?
In Long Beach?
Ed Boswell. Because his cat is just running roughshod around the whole place. So it seems like it's a house. But also there's like 15 mailboxes at the bottom of the steps.
That's the most Long Beach apartment I've ever seen in my life. So if you've ever lived in Long Beach, these older buildings were, it feels like a lot of them were built on some level with improvisation happening. Like I lived in an apartment once where it was a 3-bedroom apartment and each bedroom was 10 by, I mean, it was huge, huge, huge rooms, 2 bathrooms. And then every other apartment in the building was a very small 2-bedroom.
That's weird.
Yeah. And so, and then another time I lived in a studio apartment that had, there were probably 10 other units, but I had a private entryway up to my incredibly small studio apartment, but it was like its own staircase.
That's interesting also. So much drama in the LBC.
So, I mean, hey, we do not mince our words in Long Beach.
I didn't know it extended to the layout of apartment buildings.
So this guy's apartment, actually, while they were like walking up his private hallway, which is what this looked like, because I've had one before.
Yeah.
Miles, my husband and I were like, oh, that's definitely Long Beach. Like, that's a very Long Beach, specifically downtown Long Beach area, kind of. These old buildings are weird as hell. It's like all a Winchester Mystery House.
Yeah, it looks like it.
Yeah.
So he lets on right away that he feels like he was kind of screwed out of this company, but they don't really get to why. They just leave it at him saying that, and then going in the neck, which is a thing he says about people who he's had it with.
In the neck.
In the neck, which pick that up, everybody.
Yeah, everybody's going to have to start saying that now, FYI. It's going to be Kamala Harris at her next address. That's how she's going to end her speech. In the neck. Anyway, I also want to talk about his aesthetic really quick, which is this like very like specific 90s Dickies.
He looks like what the lead singer of Everclear probably looks like now.
Thank you.
I haven't Art Alexakis in a long time, but I bet it's getting pretty Ed Boswell up in there.
He's got, you know, like a pageboy hat on.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And
he's got sunglasses, but they're not like normal sunglasses. They're like red or blue or yellow, yeah. Which is extremely my shit. But
yeah, I totally. This isn't a critique. It's just he is a very specific looking person.
And he's never stopped trying to look cool, which is not a bad thing.
It's not a bad thing. What I'm trying to say is he's the only person. So we've got three people claiming to have started Von Dutch in this documentary. He's the only person that actually aesthetically matches the Von Dutch brand, in my opinion. His whole vibe actually looks like he created it, even though I think he was irresponsible with business practices. Like
a little bit.
And there's a reason for that. It's because he created the damn logo.
Right, right. In the neck.
In the neck.
All right, so the next person we meet, Bobby Vaughn. I dislike him for about 95% of this documentary. There's a point where I'm super duper on his side, but it's a real buzzer beater.
The point where we're on his side is like, if you're not on his side, in the neck.
In the neck.
Like it's... We're all kind of painted in a corner with Bobby at a certain point.
Yeah, if you're not on his side, you're probably Von Dutch.
If you
know what we mean, which you'll figure out.
Bobby is so much like so many guys I grew up with. It's crazy.
He's a character. He's very animated. He was adopted, which made him feel a little alienated as a kid, it seems. And by that, I mean it seems like the defining issue of his entire life.
And it doesn't really seem like his extended family is very involved in his life at this point. Which, as the documentary unfolds, you can see why, in my opinion.
Yeah, he takes a bad turn. Takes a few choices. Bad turns. He makes some questionable choices. Even, there's a thing.
We're getting there. We're getting there.
Fucking Bobby. But at first they make it seem like he started a company called the Bronze Age, but he didn't. He was just like attracted to it in some way.
He basically fell in love with this, not unlike the introduction that we're giving him. His introduction is a little scattered. I feel like there's probably a lot of this that they could have cut out. But what they tried to project is he was really trying to find a place to fit in. So he was adopted. He didn't fit in with his family. Then he became a surfer guy, but didn't really dig the, I guess, aesthetic of the surf scene. Although I could argue that he probably was also turned off by the fact that it was a pretty chill scene. And he's a pretty intense dude. He is not chill. at all. And so then he gets into this logo. He sees this logo that he apparently really loves called Bronze Age and loves it so much that he starts to buy everything and then approaches the owner and says, "Can I rep your brand?"
Right. And the brand, I think it's important to talk about what the brand was, because this was happening at really the height of gangster rap, like 93, 94, when Dr. Dre and Snoop Dogg are first coming out. And if you remember the fashion at the time, at least among West Coast rappers enthusiasts, very baggy, a lot of denim, almost kind of a jail yard look when it came to the denim. Like if you watch the movie CB3, is it CB4? God damn it. Or CB3? I think it's CB4.
I thought it was CB4.
Yeah, CB4. Very good movie.
Bronze Age is like a goth version of OP, in my opinion.
A
like
little
a goth,
bit.
A goth gangster version of OP. Because
but
it
also,
has...
Yeah, it has pockets for 40 ounces in some of the jackets, which...
Exactly.
I think we could have just said that at the beginning.
Yeah. Well, which... I mean, but it also... The thing that's hard for me to just classify it as like specifically gangster is I knew so many skater kids that wore Bronze Age too. It was always like there was always some kind of gang affiliation vibe coming off of it. But at the same time, the people that I saw wearing that stuff were genuinely like good natured dudes that just wanted to skate, drink, and that was the end of it. Like it wasn't like,
no, I'm not saying everyone who dressed like that was a gang member.
Oh, no,
like
not,
it was
I'm
like
not,
the prevalent fashion at the time. Like I wore a fucking Carhartt jacket because of shit like that.
I
lived
fighting,
in the Midwest.
I mean, you have to realize that this was like something that was all around me, and parents were constantly freaking out about whether or not their children were joining gangs or indeed just skateboarding. So it's interesting to see that that Bronze Age was connected to this story in this way, because in my mind, Von Dutch definitely is an evolution aesthetically for that specific area, very specifically. Like,
oh, yeah.
It's just very interesting.
So the next person they interview, Mike Cassell.
I do not like this guy.
He makes some questionable decisions. Like, everyone sort of has an argument going for them in this documentary in some ways. But Mike, I think they position him in this documentary as if he had just stayed in charge, things would have like grown slowly and Von Dutch would still be a cool brand. And I cannot disagree more. Like, for one thing,
I completely disagree with this.
Like, he's got, at every step of the way, he's the one who really, really fucks up. And his first interview, he's living in a trailer in the woods with a goddamn adorable dog.
Great dog.
Deserves a documentary of his own. Good, good boy. Mm-hmm. And he's smoking a pain pill at best to start this document or to start this interview. And it's a weird moment. It's not a thing you often see.
It's really weird. It's very uncomfortable. And what you learn is that basically he was an illustrator. He liked to draw and wanted to start a clothing company and was also a drug runner, and not kind of a drug runner, but has like ties to the Escobar family. Like,
the actual,
we're not talking
Escobar family.
Yeah. And then there's like a waterfall of interviews where people are basically saying, oh, we know Mike Cassell has killed people or has been involved with killing people. And it's
right.
Like, cool. Okay. So
but
you're
also,
this guy.
Also, when they give us all that background, you get a really early example of how he's a good businessman who makes dumb decisions. He had the license plate on his car when he was selling drugs for Indica, which this is the 80s, early 90s. Like, that's not, it's not legal anywhere. And even if it is, are you trying to get pulled over 3 to 4 times a week? Like, that makes zero sense.
I feel like this documentary highlights something that's super important, which is there is a big lie that's propagated from like really all aesthetic industries, like from photography to fashion to music to movies, whatever, take your pick, that like you can be this crazy outlaw and be successful in these industries. And it's like, this is not true. Because at a certain point, you're dealing with so much money that people don't want a live wire. Like, it's a complete lie. And the people that buy into this lie, like Bobby and Mike Cassell, this is how they always end up. Always.
Yeah, it's that Hunter S. Thompson shit. Like, everyone thinks they can be Hunter S. Thompson. And yes, you can be a massive asshole, which he definitely was. But you got to understand, you're not Hunter S. Thompson as a writer or as an artist, probably. And because he was so good at what he did, he was barely tolerated. Like, you got to be that good to be that fucking guy. And most people aren't. And also, Hunter S. Thompson was overrated.
Also, I think the thing is that his medium, I feel like writing is probably really one of the only mediums, truly one of the only mediums where you can actually be like this. So I will walk back my statement a little bit.
Well, also
writing is literally you. Like it's only going to come from your brain, and there's nothing anybody can do about it. Everything else, forget it.
Well, I think not necessarily everything else, but kind of the same idea. If you can work independently, as long as you don't have to be a partnership with someone, you can be as crazy as you want.
But that's the thing, is these people are not, I'm trying to talk about like these guys who had this fantasy of like chicks and fashion and all this stuff. First of all, fashion is one of the most financially impacted industries you could get involved in. Like, you are literally selling by unit. Like there's no other way to look at it. So it's so strange to me to see these people try to approach this industry as like outlaws. It's like, you're going to sell your outlaw stuff at Walmart eventually. What's the end goal? It's very interesting.
And the answer was yes.
It was yes, but from someone else.
All right. How do we feel about the fast food murder story? This is the point where Mark Rivas comes into the picture. And for a good long while there, I was like, did he just confess to a murder? There's no statute of limitations on murder. But it did turn out that Mark Rivas did serve time for what they talk about. But
explain for people that haven't watched it.
This is how Mark Rivas enters the picture. Bobby Vaughn is talking about his friendship with Mark Rivas, and it's a really important moment. What happens, Bobby Vaughn has a gun with him, and at one point he's fucking around with it and accidentally shoots through his pant leg. So Mark Rivas is like, give me the gun, just give it to me. And shortly after Mark Rivas takes the gun, a bunch of guys pull up in a van, and they almost run people over. They're being really aggressive. And they approach Mark and Bobby, and they're posturing like they want to fight. And so Mark does that thing Harrison Ford does in Indiana Jones, where the guy's like swinging the knife around and he just pulls out a gun and fucking shoots him. And everyone's like, holy shit, that's bad times. And Mark is like, well, first off, here's your gun back. And now let's run.
Yeah, gives the gun back to Bobby.
But what we find out later, the reason that part is so important, Bobby Vaughn would have gone to prison as part of that murder. There's no question. It was his gun. He handed the gun to Mark. Mark shoots the guy and gives the gun back to Bobby. Like, you're 100% an accomplice. But Mark never told anyone that Bobby gave him the gun, which raises a weird conflict for me, because it's like, now you told him. And I feel like the police could still come and be like, hey, that murder you talked about in the documentary, you were an accomplice. We're going to arrest you too. Not that the police would waste taxpayer time and money on something like that, but
it's always weird. I think they kind of muddied the storytelling a little bit in this documentary to the point where, yes, that's what's communicated, but Bobby doesn't explicitly say any of that. His baby mama girlfriend later is the one that explicitly says, right, like, these are the things. But technically what they capture on film is not a confession.
Yeah. Yeah. It's more hearsay.
So, yeah.
Which is probably why he's like, you know what? I don't want to talk about this anymore.
Yeah. They get that cool kind of burner moment, which I always like getting. Those are great in documentaries when people get up and walk away from the camera. Although Bobby does that a lot, probably because I think that guy was on something during that interview. I hate to say it.
I think he was on Being Bobby Vaughn, but
maybe that's all it was. Yeah. Maybe he's just a manic dude.
Cause like the stuff he does over the course of this documentary is
pretty manic.
Just very, very aggressive. And so Bobby Vaughn kind of inserts himself into the Bronze Age. He just
reaches out. Yeah, he says, I want to be a rep, so let me just rep your shit and try to sell it in stores, basically.
Yeah, he's like, look at me. I'm gorgeous. I'm cut. I can surf. I'll sell your clothes. And they're like, fuck yeah, dude. Come work for us. And that's when Mike Cassell makes mistake number two, I would argue, if you're counting the four Indica license plates.
We're talking big mistakes. This is number two.
This is a massive mistake. What he does, he brings in an investor very early on in the Bronze Age, and he sells the entire company for $35,000, which is the cost of all the inventory they had on hand. And they signed this deal where someone else owns the company now, but they're going to hire Bobby and Mike to work for the company. And they do that, and then they immediately fire them and file for bankruptcy, which I don't know the logistics of how you make money with a scheme like that. But he basically gave the company away immediately.
I think it's a tax thing. Yeah, I think maybe people will buy up failing businesses and absorb a bunch of their money that way.
And it's at this point that Von Dutch becomes an idea for a clothing brand.
Like, so Bronze Age is no more,
right?
Just to explicitly say it. And the other thing to note is that Mike was designing. This is another really important part. Mike basically is on a cocaine run and gets caught and sent to prison is designing graphics from his jail cell for Bronze Age, which I think, you know, doubled the street cred kind of a thing that I'm sure that the lore of that was pretty helpful, I guess. I just think it's important to say, because then he gets out, he meets Bobby. Bobby's like, I'm going to sell your shit. And then he immediately makes this horrible business decision. And then suddenly the two of them decide to go to an apparel show and find the next big thing. And that's when the moment happens.
That's when they find Ed Boswell and the Von Dutch patches. They start making jeans and t-shirts. What I like is that if you bought Von Dutch clothing in those early days, you were just like buying Dickies that had Von Dutch patches on them. They just took the Dickies patches off. And that's like, it seems like Ed Boswell, once they get in touch with him, is the one who's got the idea to put these Von Dutch patches on things. And Mike and Bobby and Ed run with it at first.
That's the whole brand, is just literally putting patches on hard denim.
Yeah.
That's kind of it. Like, you know.
This is the point where we meet Eli Jane also, who is eventually becomes Bobby Vaughn's wife, right? They get married, I think.
I am not clear, I'll be honest. They're together for a long time. She's
the first model and first investor in Von Dutch, and also at the time a huge crystal meth fan, which by the time this documentary happens, she hasn't done crystal meth in like 21 years.
You can tell she doesn't look like it, thank God.
Yeah,
bless your heart.
She still looks great. So they introduce her, and she's kind of important to the story, but it's more just because she was there.
I don't think she's important at all. I don't know why she was in it. She's the one interview where I'm like, because first of all, the way Bobby talks, like tells the story of how he meets this woman is all over the map. That should have been completely cut. This is my biggest critique of this documentary.
Yes,
is,
I agree. This, if anything could have been cut, it's
there's
this storyline.
No reason for this storyline to be in this documentary other than how he ended up being a father.
Right. And even then he could be like, I had a kid around this time.
That's it. Like, that's all we needed. She's
registered. That information is registered. We can move
on. Because as it moves on in my head, I'm thinking, oh, so she's going to be part of like trying to get her money back and things like that. That never happens. I mean, there's other than just having a female voice in this, which there aren't many, but that's no shocker. I don't know why she's in this documentary.
So they introduce her, and then we find out how Von Dutch really got their big break. Which is interesting, because I remember this moment vividly because I was a big fan of MTV Cribs.
One of the best reality shows ever.
Best episode in IMHO, Redman, who was a rapper from New Jersey who took them to his two-bedroom townhouse in New Jersey. It had like a broken doorbell. There was a dollar box for running to the store on top of the refrigerator.
The Mariah Carey episode is.
Well, of course.
That's the iconic one, right? Actually, and this episode that we talk about in this is another one that was pretty crazy.
The Tommy Lee episode, which the thing that always stuck with me was he had a Starbucks in his house. I was like, man, yes, that's how a rich person lives. You're fucking right. So basically what happens, Bobby gets introduced to Tommy Lee. First, he gets introduced to Pamela Anderson. She introduces him to Tommy Lee. Bobby's hanging out at Tommy Lee's house. They're having an actual party. It's exactly what you imagine is happening at Tommy Lee's house. And Tommy Lee eventually goes to bed, at which point a camera crew from MTV shows up. And Bobby answers the door and they're like, "We're filming today." And he's like, "Tommy's asleep." And they're like, "We are filming today."
Can you imagine? That's got to be how it was almost every single time they did that show.
Yeah.
I mean,
like, once you're that rich, like, there's no rules in your life. Like, no. You might be a nice enough person to follow
rules. But you
rules.
Just, like, I'm just imagining firing off a text like, "Sorry, Adam, I can't record today. I forgot that they were filming my house this week." I mean, that's normally something that people would spend a month getting ready for.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I have to clean my house for Thanksgiving 2 days, like for 2 days.
But Tommy Lee swings into action because he's Tommy Lee. Like, all he's got to do is go rejoin the party and show a camera crew around.
His forever party.
And Bobby Vaughn has the brilliant idea to, one, give Tommy Lee a Von Dutch shirt, because at first he's wearing a Marshall shirt, I believe. And Bobby is like, "Man, will you put on this Von Dutch shirt?" And Tommy Lee's like, "Of course, bro." And then Bobby puts Von Dutch stickers on the tank tops all the girls are wearing. So there's not even Von Dutch tank tops at this point in history, but it looks like they're all wearing Von Dutch. And people see this episode and it fucking blows up. Easy peasy. It's what we need to happen with this podcast. We need to be at Tommy Lee's house when they bring back MTV Cribs.
That's the easy part.
They walk through like the pool area and you and I live podcasting it up.
Yeah,
and
they just leave the camera on us. Yeah. Forget the house. Who are these two fascinating individuals?
Well, then you understand Tommy Lee's shirt, which is an owl with one of the red lines crossing 100%. It out.
Now they all understand.
Yeah.
And he's eating pizza rolls.
Pizza rolls. Maybe some surprise chicken if you watch the extended episode.
And some nice, a nice little bit of Rao's pasta sauce on the side for some dipping.
So right after Von Dutch takes off, this is the point where they decide to fuck Ed Boswell out of the company, which has to make it sting even a little bit worse. Like, they don't even give him any money. Like, he was promised, like, I think it was like 1%. Like,
but see, that's the thing. This Mike guy is a snake. He's not creating contracts for anybody. Nobody's signing anything except for his bad decisions.
Yeah, Mike seems like he doesn't operate in good faith a whole lot.
But he asks everybody around him to do that. This is like the perfect trait of a toxic person. Like, where's your loyalty? Why don't you trust me? And then bam, it's classic. It is absolutely classic.
And at the end of the first episode, that's when they introduce the fourth key figure in this. The reason I couldn't get his name right early on, it's not Sonny. It's Tony, T-O-N-N-Y, but they called him like Tunny.
Oh, he's got five different names in this documentary.
Or like Tawny. I think it was Tawny, but we're calling him Tony. Fuck that.
I'm calling him Tony. I can't do that. He's my favorite part of the documentary.
Yeah, he's Tony Sorensen. He's a world taekwondo champion, which is cool as shit. Like, he's legit good at it. Like,
the other thing about this man,
fuck you up,
that I find fascinating is that he's got a reason behind every single thing that he does. And I gotta respect that, like, on some level. Like,
I would argue he goes through the most shit. Like,
yes. Not expecting what he gets.
No. Not at all.
And by goes through the most shit, it's what he puts out is not equal to what he gets back as far as the weirdness that comes his way, in my opinion. No. Like, he just tries to make normal business decisions every step of the way, even though sometimes that can be very cutthroat and shitty. It's still business. He's the only one actually trying to run this thing as a business.
Right. And he comes on as basically like an angel investor. Like, he's got a lot of money, again, because he married a rich Brazilian woman. Episode 2 is called The Art of War. So now we're going places. And it starts with an interview with Tony Sorensen. Mike Cassell super duper hates Tony Sorensen. We find that out.
But don't you get the sense that Mike Cassell would hate Tony Sorensen even if he was never in business with him? I feel like he made a deal with somebody that he despises anyway.
Yeah, Mike Cassell had kind of a Kurt Cobain aesthetic to him, where he was constantly doing everything he could to make his brand as huge as possible and then resenting how big his brand was getting at the same time. Like, one of my main gripes about Kurt Cobain, beside the fact that he was secretly terrible to women, even though he's held up as this feminist icon, is that he complained so much about being a rock star and also did all the things necessary to become a huge rock star. It's like, no one's stopping you from quitting your band and putting out a solo acoustic album. It's fucking America, dude. Go do it. But he never did. Instead, he got murdered by his wife. So what happened? I blacked out.
I didn't say that. We didn't say anything like that on our show.
Yeah. So these two meet. Tony and Mike meet. And again, Mike does the thing that is required to take your business to the next level. He brings in this investor and he gives Tony 51% of the company. And I don't know what the breakdown was among the others. And they also make him CEO.
He also doesn't draw up a contract with Bobby. That's important later.
Yes. There's no real contract. Like, Bobby is just kind of a fringe employee, sort of.
I think he probably just works on a percentage. Like, when he, yeah. I mean, that's usually how sellers' jobs work. It's like, you get paid when you sell however many units, I guess. It's never, ever explicitly explained how Bobby ever got paid.
Yeah. And so Bobby, I have in the notes, doesn't even, like, no one even mentions Bobby Vaughn in this part. There are people who are like, Bobby Vaughn. Yeah, I kind of remember him. But for the most part, people are like, hmm? I don't know. And
because he's a sales rep.
Yeah. And so the Von Dutch is still losing money at this point. Tony is pumping out a ton of money to keep them afloat. And it seems like Bobby's job at this point was partying really hard and pretending it was in the name of promoting Von Dutch. Like, he's going to parties. He's got people dressed in Von Dutch. And it seems like that's about it, which I don't think, it's definitely not a check in the positive column for his argument about what happens next.
I think he has a very outsized idea of what he was owed by this company. Bobby does.
Right.
And this is maybe the only thing I agree with Mike Cassell on, which is like, he basically says, I didn't owe him anything. And he was right. He didn't make Mike sign a contract. He didn't have a real job. So
he's got the least claim to being the creator of Von Dutch in that first episode. Like, he was just kind of there at the beginning.
He didn't create shit.
And here's the thing about, like, he gets screwed out of the company. And here's the thing about how it happens. He deserved it. Like, he deserved to be fucked out of the company, because what he does, he meets up with Mark Rivas again. And it turns out Mark Rivas was prosecuted for that murder. And now he's out and they're back in L.A. And
the way it's framed, too, is that the second Mark Rivas is out of jail and the two of them are together again, everything else in Bobby's life falls apart.
Right. Right.
I don't like that. And I don't buy that.
Yeah.
I just want to say this, like, it, the, whatever, like, flimsy lifestyle he had going, he built that. And then this person comes back into his life and he wants to be a gangster. That's the thing, is that that's all he ever really wanted to do, is like be this dude that rolls up in the club. And I mean, seriously, that's, he doesn't care about the brand or anything.
To some extent, it seems like, because they keep bringing up that the relationship between Mark and Bobby is like a wife and her abusive husband. And in this case, Mark Rivas is the abusive husband and Bobby is the one being abused. I think they lean on that a little too hard. Like, Bobby goes along. He goes at best, he goes along with some very ill-advised shit.
His wife person, this girl that's interviewed in this.
Yeah.
The circumstances of her leaving are, she leaves him and the child, and the circumstances around that are never really clear in the documentary. So I'm sure there was like a drug issue there. And then he loses custody of the child. So I'm sorry, this is not like a victim, in my opinion.
Well, not even in the business thing that happens. Because Bobby brings Mark Rivas back to LA and basically forces Von Dutch to hire Mark Rivas as part of the company. And The thing is, people, they do this by walking into Tony's office and pulling guns on him, which that's bad business. That's not acting in good faith, I would argue. And then he's got the nerve to be upset when what Tony does is basically make him sign a contract that gives away all of his rights to Von Dutch. He hires him for, I think, $18,000 a year as an employee. And he's like, yeah, go off and do whatever you want, but you can't make any of this stuff. And at one point, Bobby makes jeans, and that was a violation of his contract. And Tony was like, fuck you, you're fired. And it didn't take long for that to happen. And now Bobby feels all indignant about, like, to this day, about getting kicked out of the company. And it's like, you pulled a gun on your business partner, man. Don't do that.
To me, it's just so funny. There's a lot of this, like, self, I don't even know what the word is, this kind of woe is me shit in this documentary that weirdly reminds me of that episode of A Ghost Ruined My Life the bonus episode that we just let out. Like,
yeah,
it's just like, some people make mistake after mistake after mistake, and the only thing they have to say at the end of it is, I don't know what happened. I don't know how my life got here. And it's like, what are you talking about? You just told me how your life got here. You just literally told me that you walked into technically your boss's office with a gun and demanded to get rehired, and it didn't work out the way you did get rehired. You just didn't read the contract, and then you violated the contract that you didn't read.
Yeah. Yeah.
Excuse me?
Yeah. And that is very much painted as Tony taking advantage of him. And it's
I thought he made this one of the smartest business moves.
Yeah. Cause there's even a lawyer who's like, Tony got him to sign a contract without legal representation. It's not illegal. Like, it's your job to go get a lawyer and have them look that over. And he didn't do it. And also, he pulled a gun on his business partner.
Just insane.
Like, was
There's
that?
No I hope, excuse.
I hope that was in the contract. Like, also, if you pull a fucking gun on me again, you also lose your right to that.
Well, and what's also infuriating about this guy is that it's disclosed later that he sued the company and got settlement money out of this.
After blew my mind.
He pulled a gun.
Well, he didn't just pull a gun on Tony. Next, Bobby and Mark do the smart thing and lure Mike Cassell to a clothing store, tie him to a chair, beat him, and try to force him to sign over rights to Von Dutch. And for some reason, he says, I'll do it tomorrow. And they're like, cool, you're untied. And then they go to meet the next day. And it turns out someone, not Mike Cassell, in fact, but someone called the police and they storm the fucking meeting. And they don't arrest Bobby and Mark, but it's implied that they kind of save Mike Cassell from probably being murdered.
I have such a hard time feeling sorry for this Bobby person. It's interesting because it really is a documentary where there's nobody involved that you actually like. Not really, not like a cleanly, like, I really like this person.
Yeah.
Except for the clothing rep that gets hired later that we're going to get to. I really like him. The alien whisperer. We'll get to him in a minute.
Oh, but yeah. That guy fucking rips.
Yeah. He rules. I have a big crush on that guy. I love that guy.
But they bring in another guy next. After all of the dust settles from all this, Mike is still in the company. Tony's still in the company. Ed Boswell. It's mostly just Mike and Tony at this point. Bobby Vaughn is Bobby gone. Oh, Caitlin, that rhymed.
Oh, Adam Todd with 1D Brown.
It rhymed.
It was very funny.
So the next guy they bring in, Christian Audigier, who is a real character. He reminds me of Bruno Tomioli from Dancing with the Stars, which enough with the highly relatable references. We can move on.
He reminds me of like a Sacha Baron Cohen character.
Yeah.
He is like truly larger than life, this person.
He really
is. And is the only reason that Von Dutch ends up taking off the way that it does. And also later flaming the way that it does.
But yeah, he's responsible for, in terms of just the brand recognition and respect for the brand, he is responsible for the rise and the fall. of that. And we find out a very, very unsurprising detail about him in the postscript to this, which is that he went on to found Ed Hardy.
I mean.
And of course,
Ed Hardy.
Of course, the guy behind Von Dutch Dogware is the guy who founded Ed Hardy.
Oh, my God.
But at first, he does a really smart thing and gets him into women's clothes, which that helps.
Oh, yeah, because it's not fashion is driven by women mostly, in my opinion.
And it goes really well, which for some reason, Mike Cassell is bitter about. Like he doesn't because he's got this aesthetic he claims at the beginning of the episode where you're authentic to what you do.
But he never even designed the patch that the brand was built around. That's what blows my mind. His whole philosophy about branding and product. Go kick rocks, dude. You didn't actually do any of that.
Yeah, he's a frustrating character.
He's impossible. That's what I'm saying is like he is an impossible person.
Yeah, he seems like a hard person to work with. And what happens here is the women's side of things is super duper taking off. And Mike is bothered by this and things get really tense at the office. And so speaking of things that make some of these founding members not so sympathetic characters, Mike, for some reason, in the midst of all of this fucking hockey stick shaped success that's happening with Von Dutch, takes Tony to breakfast and is like, Tony, I'd like you to meet my friend. He's a hitman. If you or I ever need someone killed, we can just reach out to this guy and he'll do it. And that's just a slightly more cordial way of waving a gun at your business partner. It's like, what the fuck did you do that for?
Because they see this shit in movies and think that it works.
Yeah.
Honestly, I guess. Like that's genuinely what this comes down to. Like this is a fantasy. This is a clear example of a person who thinks they exude an energy that they don't.
Right. And basically, for some reason, Tony is very bothered by this incident. And he executes an option in the contract that basically puts Mike in the position where he either needs to buy the company or just walk away from the company. And what he has to do to buy Tony out is come up with $200,000. And Tony is like, well, you're this great businessman.
$2 million.
I think it's only
$200,000. Oh.
And Tony is like, well, you're this great businessman. You got all these connections. Go raise the money. Give me that. And I'll be done.
Hitmen, you're set.
And it turns out that Mike cannot raise that money. So he just kind of loses the company, which.
And this is kind of I understand that Tony married a Brazilian lady who had a lot of money.
Right.
But it says a lot that he even thought to put this clause into the contract when he initially signed Mike, like made this deal with Mike Cassell. It shows, in my opinion, a lot of foresight with this person. Like, okay, I'm going to be putting in a lot of money. And if you start to go AWOL, I need to be able to get out, basically. And I think it's a really brilliant contract clause. it saved his ass.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
You know,
the only problem is at this point, Von Dutch is losing money every year. Lots of money, like millions of dollars every year.
Yeah.
And now Tony is the sole owner. He treats us to a very confusing quote about being in the middle of the third round.
I don't understand that quote.
And yeah, he literally says, I have this quote that I always say, and then just goes on this rambling, like 250 word thing about how if you're in the middle of the third round, you can still win. It's like,
maybe he just thought the quote was, we're still in the third round. Maybe that's what he was trying to say. But I still don't understand because in my head, I'm like, what if you're really behind and you're in the third round?
Yeah. And they were really, really behind.
And you have one round left. So very confused.
But this is also the point where they make possibly their best decision of all, which is to start selling trucker hats. And they also make another very smart decision, which was Tony's idea to sell them for a lot of money. Like they're selling trucker hats for like $50 and $60.
It worked.
And everyone thought that was a terrible idea. They put their first round of trucker hats out and they sell out in a couple of days. So they know they're onto something. And their plan ends up being to just kind of give shit away to celebrities. And the man who really makes that happen, the absolute, possibly the only sympathetic character in this. I mean, there's there's the woman from marketing
Sandberg avatar.
Yeah, she's just there to tell you more things that happened. Like, she's pretty inoffensive.
Well, and she's so corporate.
Yeah, yeah. Real
anything out of her for that.
But Tracy Mills, who
I am in love with him. Like, no wonder all the celebrities just like hanging out with him. That's like his whole vibe is, and I find him a very compelling foil to Bobby. Because he is who Bobby thinks he is.
Oh, yeah, 100%. There's a quote where Kanye West says that people like Tracy Mills because he can talk to aliens. And what he actually means is celebrities. Like, celebrities feel like aliens to normal people in a lot of cases. And not to this guy. He has befriended so many celebrities already by this point. And he's basically like, yeah, I can bring celebrities into the store. Of course, that's what I do.
Yeah, he has a meeting with that Christian guy. Right. And that is really, I think, a moment of genius that Tommy can't take credit for. Tommy can take credit for the hat thing. But as far as the implementation of the brand in celebrity world, that was Christian.
Right.
And basically hiring somebody to just bring celebrities in to take everything that they want.
My favorite celebrity coming in to take whatever they want moment is Whitney Houston.
That it's the best. It is such a great, it's worth the whole documentary. It is literally worth sitting through the whole documentary to watch Tommy talk about his reaction to Whitney Houston coming in.
Yes, because it's a very quintessential Whitney Houston moment. If you know her background and her actual backstory.
Yeah.
Because most celebrities will come in and be like, can I have those two pairs of jeans and like that hat and I'm good. Whitney Houston takes 30 bags of shit when they walk her through the store, because that's what they would do. They would just, celebrities could just come take whatever they want with the understanding that they would wear it to shit. And that really worked because of Tracy Mills. Like, he was that conduit between celebrities and Von Dutch.
But Tommy talking about Whitney Houston is so good.
Oh yeah.
Because, and I love his attitude, because like one of his like sales associates walks up to him and says like, Tommy, she's taking 30 bags. And he says, have you heard her voice?
Yeah. He's like, you let her take 30 bags. It's Whitney Houston. What are you thinking?
I'm like, yes, that's what I would say too. Like, she's just going to rob me blind, I guess, because it's a good business decision, and B, listen to her. She's the most beautiful voice in the world.
And also at this point, they're doing $150 million a year in sales. So this is like Vanilla Ice being nominated for Grammys.
Yeah.
Point. If you're comparing their trajectories, which are very similar, Von Dutch was big for a few more years than Vanilla Ice, but it crashes and burns just as fast.
Yeah, the Paris Hilton stuff is fascinating too.
Oh yeah, because we've now reached episode 3, which is called Von Douche, which is a very lighthearted title for an episode we've been promised is going to end in murder.
I remember like when I saw the title of that episode, I'm like, oh yeah, I remember people saying that. Like, I had forgotten completely about the Von Douche thing, but I remember now.
Yeah, and they try to shoehorn in this thing called the Curse of Von Dutch, where they're like, anyone who's ever tried to do anything with his brand has suffered some weird fate. And it's like, yeah, that's what this documentary is about. It seems like no one else has done shit with his name. Like, they're trying to like add some sort of paranormal element to it. I don't think we needed that. But anyway, Mike, for some reason, is really bent out of shape about how big the brand has become ever since he took Tony to breakfast with a hitman. And he's also been out of shape about how he feels like it's becoming a joke. Like, this wasn't for the Paris Hiltons of the world. This was supposed to be for bikers, man, and tough guys who specialize in pinstriping and hate minorities.
So annoying. He's so annoying.
Yeah, it's like, I would be salty too, but some of that would be me looking in the mirror and going, you shouldn't have done that breakfast.
What I don't like about this person is that he can't admit that he made a mistake. It has to be hoisted onto some larger, he's a martyr, a philosophical martyr, and he couldn't stomach the brand. No, what it was is that he couldn't stomach that it wasn't his ideas that were skyrocketing the brand. That's right. What bothered him. That's all it was. And he may not even be aware of that, but that's exactly what happens when, you know, it's thoughts like that that trigger the kind of self-destructive behavior that he engaged in and created the situation for himself that he finds himself in now.
Yeah. And so here's where we get to Paris Hilton. She's kind of held up as the peak of Von Dutch success and also the point where it stops being cool and starts being Von Douche.
Yeah. She literally synthesizes the entire process. And it's all her.
That's why she's interviewed in this.
She also she introduces herself as a fashion icon, which I gotta respect.
That. Yeah.
I gotta respect that. I love Paris Hilton. People are so shitty about her, and it's like
Also Stars Are Blind is a fucking banger.
I love that. And we could talk about how also Kim Kardashian's pretty great. Everybody shits on her too. It's like, oh, I'm sorry, have you freed anybody from prison lately? Have you done that? Were you able to do that?
I wrote a Cracked article about that.
She's awesome.
Kardashians. And another thing that I really liked about Paris Hilton was The Simple Life, which was a reality show, but a highly scripted reality show.
Genius. But the show was so good.
And they wore a lot of Von Dutch on that show.
She called it their uniform. She said before they went to Arkansas, they just went and cleared out the store, and that's all they wore while they were on their trip.
My favorite moment, I don't know. I can't have one favorite moment, but there was...
Don't choose between your children today, Adam. It's a holiday weekend.
There was one where they're working at a restaurant, and this guy kept... one of the managers kept like cracking down on Nicole Richie whenever she would touch something. He'd be like, wash your hands again. And then she started doing it to him. Like everything he would touch, she was like, hey, wash your hands.
Nicole Richie is so smart too.
I love Nicole Richie.
I love every single time. Like there was one where this kid was like working at the front desk of some office. And she's like, how old are you? And he's like 18. She's like, that's hot.
Yeah.
And he just like fell apart. It was so good. He didn't know what to do. Ah.
So, yeah, that show and Paris Hilton, the brand, make Von Dutch bigger than ever. And for some reason, Bobby Vaughn sees Paris Hilton at a club and decides to confront her about
another brilliant choice.
Yeah, it's like, you fucking suck, dude. Don't do things like this. And he decides once again that the way to rectify his business gripes is to find Tony and wave some guns at him. This time they do it in traffic while Tony has one of like the VP of sales in the car with him. And they just like stop an SUV in front of Tony while he's driving and like wave guns at him and then pull off. And it's like,
but it's the same weird, like limp dick shit over and over again. These guys just like, hey, just FYI. It's like, that's not going to work. Like you're just going to get sued again or something. Like, stop it.
And it's like, what? Yeah. What do you think's going to happen? Like, and I think this is where the abusive relationship aspect with Mark Rivas comes into play because none of these things are working and they're not making any money, Mark Rivas gets really mad and dangles Bobby Vaughn from a balcony, which that is some Vanilla Ice Suge Knight shit. And he robs Bobby of a gun so he can kill himself.
This is probably the only part of the story where I feel sorry for Bobby, if I could say that. Because I really do believe he completely built this situation for himself. There's no one else to look to. You lose custody of your kids. It's like, you know how hard it is to lose custody of your kids in California, Adam? Like they will leave kids with people for as long as humanly possible. Like it's, so I don't know what led to that, but the way he describes it is like, they took my kid away. Harshest goodbye ever.
He explains. I bet. His
kid. Damn.
But Mark doesn't kill himself. Bobby stops him. He like kicks Bobby in the bathroom door and tackles him. And so there's more stuff about the company getting even bigger while all this is happening.
There's a lot of you can yada yada through that. but it kind of has to be in the documentary because it's there.
Mark tries to rob Bobby's girlfriend at one point, and Bob, who is a Playboy playmate, and she wears this big ass ring, and Mark is like, rob her and take that ring. And he's like, she's my girlfriend. I'm not going to rob my girlfriend. And Mark is like, well, then I'll do it. And Bobby is so loyal to Mark. He literally says, well, I didn't feel like I could intervene because Mark has been my friend forever.
Any goodwill that I had for him at that moment bottomed out. I'm like, all right, well, you're, and then he, and that's when he pulls the, it's kind of like I was in a bad relationship. No, dude, like that's.
It sounds like your girlfriend was in a bad relationship. Yeah, and the funniest part is she fights Mark Rivas off. Just
drives
gets
off with him as he's jumping on the hood of her car. Yeah. Like, good for her.
Movie shit. So, yeah, they start. There's two different incidents that happen here. And they kind of keep jumping back and forth between them. And we are not going to do that. I'm just going to tell you what they both are.
Yeah.
One, a team of, I think it's appropriate to say thugs. They are part of the Escobar family, and they have come for shady business.
Literally textbook thugs.
Textbook
thugs. That's not you being like a generalist.
No. And they show up at Von Dutch headquarters, and they demand a meeting with Tony. And they're like, you get $500,000, and you lose the company, and you have to take this deal, basically. And Tony has to be like, fucking again. Like, imagine being this guy who just invested in this company. You've made it huge. And shit like this keeps it. It's not just that, like.
It's so funny. I mean, it's funny now to me. But it's like, it's just amazing that these guys thought these plans. It just, how many video games have you been playing? What movies were you watching? Where is this coming from? Because this isn't how business works. Even if you want it to work that way, it doesn't.
Yeah, like if you enter into a contract with someone in a way that would also allow them to call the police and have you arrested, that contract's not going to hold up in court. Like, what are you doing?
Oh, it's duress.
And like the Escobar family doesn't have time to keep pursuing this. They're going to do it once. And if you call their bluff, they're going to be like, all right, fuck it. We were just doing it for this guy anyway.
I almost feel like coming in with the money weakens anything that they had to say. It should have just been like, you have to give up your company or we're going to kill you. But of course, they're not going to do that, because if they do that, then it's a real threat, which is why, you know, none of this is real anyway.
I do like that Tony mentions that at this point, he started thinking about who to taekwondo first to get out of this situation, which is a legitimate thought for him to have.
Full Uncle Rico right there. Like,
that was
great. I was not expecting him to say that at all. He's like, I was sitting there with the money on my desk and I was looking at everybody and I just started thinking, okay, I'm going to punch him here. I'm going to kick this guy in the neck. It's just, it's like dudes on parade. This documentary, it's crazy.
And he does the obvious thing. He signs the contract and then he just calls the police. And he's like, well, here's what happened to me. Fucking handle it.
Yeah.
And so they don't lose the company, obviously. I don't think they happened at the same time, but they make it seem like they're happening at the same time. But meanwhile,
back at the ranch,
back at Bobby's apartment, there's just been this huge blow up with Mark Rivas.
Same night. So Bobby's girlfriend drives off. Mark survives surfing on her car, I guess, goes back into the apartment that he and Bobby were sharing. And then what?
And then Bobby is scared because Mark Rivas is clearly on one tonight. And Bobby makes it back to his apartment. He locks the door and Mark Rivas is outside, or maybe it's just his bedroom in their apartment. But Mark Rivas is outside knocking on the door and saying, chalk it up, which is their slang for you're about to get murdered. And Bobby has a gun in his room.
Can I just note that if you have a common like little nomenclature for you're about to get murdered amongst your friends, you've made some bad choices.
Yeah, you're a bad friend group. And one that most people should not want to enter. Like, I'm not even getting in a text group with them.
No, although now I'm definitely going to be texting you, chalk it up. But go ahead.
Chalk it up.
Chalk it up. In the neck.
In the neck. Which, appropriate for what happens next, Mark is finally able to break through Bobby's door, so Bobby shoots him. He kills him. They get in a little scuffle, and Bobby, feeling like his life was in danger, which is understandable. There's a man with a gun kicking down your door. And Bobby survives, basically. And what it really bothered me that he even went on trial for that.
Me too.
Like that, you know, that was some racially motivated shit.
Yeah.
Because it was clear that that was self-defense. Someone is breaking down your door with
like
a gun.
Jack Torrance style.
Yeah.
You like, know, that's scary.
Anyone seeing that happen, if you then see them shoot the person breaking through the door, you're going to be like, yeah, of course, that's what you do.
I think what they did, like if this is just my guess, it was the 911 call because they play the 911 call.
Yeah. And he just says, I shot my friend.
Bobby is just saying he killed somebody and that's it. And instead of somebody was trying to get me and I shot them and just left it at pro tip.
Yeah.
You know, like I think the 911 call and plus probably we don't get into what kind of state of mind Bobby was in when the police are there. You know, like he even says that he was on drugs. He talks about it in the documentary that he was on drugs. So I agree with you. I'm sure there was like racial elements to it. But on top of that, it would be very hard to know for sure if this person's story is true or not.
Yeah.
Honestly.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of stuff surrounding his trial.
Bobby is his own worst enemy, is what I'm saying here.
Oh, yeah.
Like, that's, there we go.
Yeah,
that's,
in most situations in this documentary.
Yeah.
But I you don't want him to get convicted. They get into a bunch of his trial, and he's found not guilty on all charges because it was clearly self-defense. So,
yeah.
That part's good. Now, the way the company dies is Christian Audigier, who is the Borat character that they bring in to, as Caitlin said, to blow up the company. At one point, Tony's like, people are seeing our logo too much, and you have to scale back a little, or people are going to get very tired of seeing us. And Christian is like, okay, that, but opposite. What I'm going to do is put the logo on everything. And they start putting it on dog clothes. It's the dog clothes that really kill them. But they get into like kids' clothes.
I think it's the kids' clothes. Because I remember seeing like some kids in that. And I vividly remember looking at my friend. Because everyone we knew that wore Von Dutch were party animals. Like it's like a cheesy way to say it, but like, so to see a kid in Von Dutch was like, uh-oh, like that's the dog thing, whatever. Cause I grew up with like Chanel outfits with dogs I could get, but the kid stuff was like, oh, that's not good.
Yeah. They're doing energy drinks, like all this weird shit. And they also find out Christian is getting kickbacks from all of these deals. So he's literally stealing from the company. And that's the point where the company starts being known as Von Douche. And the marketing lady, in describing how quickly things fell from that point, she says, it's almost like a rock star who dies at 26. It's 27. It's the 27 club, ma'am, not the 26 club.
Yeah.
Get it right. So they, well, let's skip a little bit and talk about how this documentary truly ends. Because I love when you think a documentary is all about one thing, and then they're like, oh, also this. Did you know
it's
this?
It's a good ending. It's a good ending.
And what we find out is that in 2004, we find out Von Dutch, super duper racist. Before he died, shortly before his death, he wrote a letter that said, among other things, I am not willing to go through it anymore, only to emerge in a place full of Mexicans and Jews.
Hmm.
Fucking yikes, Von Dutch.
Yeah, that's not kind of racist.
But there's more. Here's another quote. I have always been a Nazi and still believe it was the last time the world had a good chance of being operated with a logic. Goddamn, Von Dutch.
Okay. Okay.
And now I mentioned at the beginning, the first Purge movie, where there's that character who shows up and then disappears for most of the story and then comes back in a really huge way. Ed Boswell, the first person.
My Long Beach buddy.
first person to get fucked out of the company is also the person who eventually breaks this Nazi story. Because it turns out the whole time he had a massive collection of Von Dutch shit and this letter was in it. And that also brings up kind of a conflict.
No kidding.
Because he's positioning this as, got him. I'm a fucking, I showed them goddamn hero.
He was trying to build his life around this thing too.
Yeah. And Tony's like, so you knew he was a Nazi and decided to start making shirts anyway? Cool. That makes you look really good too. And that's a great fucking point.
Yeah. He's the one that actually knew.
Yeah. So he created Von Dutch in that he didn't tell anyone it was essentially a Nazi brand.
It looked like it, though. That's what's crazy, is that it always signaled that to me. As a kid, I was like, there's something weird and white supremacist about this, and I don't know why I don't like it, but I don't like it.
Looks like the Hugo Boss of skateboarding. So that's the episode. That's the documentary. Bobby did sue and got an undisclosed sum of money. Apparently, Mike has not. He's just...
Bobby should not have won a lawsuit.
I don't think so either. The waving guns at your partner twice really doesn't sit well with me in terms of business law, but apparently there's two sides to that story. Holy shit.
I guess. I don't know. It's a good documentary. I feel like they do try to kind of paint Tommy as this like total douchebag, but I don't think he is at all, really. I think he just is an entrepreneur that seized on an opportunity, and that's what Mike Cassell was doing too. He just did it badly.
Yeah. Their only real gripe with Tony is that he made it bigger and kind of oversaw it becoming something that Mike Cassell didn't want it to be. And that's why I hate at the end when they're like, yeah, if Mike stayed in charge, it would probably just still be cool clothing brand. It's like, man, he would have fucking sold it for $150,000 and gotten fucked out of that too.
Yeah, that's the best case scenario. Because the thing is people like this who refuse to take responsibility for themselves are not good business people. Like at the end of the day, unless they're a trust fund kid, they're not going to make it. You have to be Donald Trump in order for that behavior to turn into anything beyond what we saw in this documentary.
I love that it ends with shots of people throwing the hats back, because they start the documentary by tossing hats to all of the celebrities and people that they interview. And they reveal this thing about, oh, he was also a Nazi, and then immediately cut to people throwing the hats back, except Tracy Mills.
My boyfriend?
Who...
so in love with him.
He keeps the hat, which... he had no idea Ed Hardy was racist. Neither did I. Or not Ed Hardy, Von Dutch.
Tomato, tomato. But yeah, go ahead.
Neither did I. Like, the story broke in 2004. I had no idea. So they show him the letter, and he's like, holy shit, Von Dutch. That is super racist. And but also, he's the only one that doesn't throw the hat back, which I feel like Von Dutch would have hated. Which makes
that's what it, I know his whole reaction's great, because he's like, well, I love it because, you know, it was me who made this brand what it is.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. So
I think
he's like,
says something like God must have seen him and be like, okay, I got you.
Yeah. He's probably the only person that could bring Von Dutch back and make it a thing people cared about again. But
Unless we are living in such a crazy country and time where people are going to watch this now and ironically buy Von Dutch stuff, which I think is completely possible.
Oh, that'll for sure happen. That will for sure happen. It'll be
God, looking back on the fashion of the early 2000s, it's like, it's so bright and like tacky. It was just such a stupid time for clothing.
Yeah. I'm glad I was working an office job at the time.
And yeah, I was like a teenager. Nothing. It didn't matter what I wore.
Yeah, I didn't have to get out and impress people. Like, I just had to wear khakis 4 days a week, and then I could wear jeans on Friday because we're free.
God bless America.
So that's our episode. That was a long one.
We covered three episodes of a documentary in one podcast episode. I would say it's like Spark Notes, but not really, because you still... It's a long Spark Notes situation.
Yeah, you could get through a sizable chunk of the documentary
itself. I give this
like
3 out of 4 stars.
Yeah, yeah. It's good.
It's got some problems, though.
I just don't like that it kind of glosses over the actions of a couple of those people and tries to make it seem like
also
they got screwed.
They bring in Mark Reeves's brother for like 30 seconds.
Yeah.
And all he says is, hey, I'm just here to represent my brother. And that's all he says.
Yeah. He's like, my brother was a good dude. It's like, have you seen this documentary?
See you later. Like, I don't know what that, I don't know why they included that. There's a couple things in this where I'm like, why didn't you just cut that out? Like,
yeah.
You didn't, this doesn't really do anything. They really, the girlfriend, baby mama probably did not need to be in there. I don't see the point in that at all because
yeah.
Bobby basically acts like she didn't exist.
Yeah.
So
basically,
you know, it's just, I don't know.
So yeah, that's it.
That's it.
Do we have anything to plug before we get out of here?
I hope everybody's having a good holiday season.
Yeah, me too. Well, yeah, holiday season. We'll be past Thanksgiving. How was your Thanksgiving, Caitlin?
I'm still full.
Me too. I hope I can eat solid food by then. We'll see how it goes. Yeah, I don't have patreon.com/unpops, unpopsnetwork.supercast.tech, and you can get bonus episodes right on Spotify these days. If you listen to podcasts in the Spotify app, fucking look around. There's probably a subscription button somewhere.
Take a little spin through the old podcast world.
I don't listen to podcasts. I can't tell you where it is. Caitlin, do you have anything to plug?
Go to our Instagram, Pretty Scary Boo.
Oh, yeah.
On Instagram. I'm on there putting around for us. So come say hi.
Get on there, you
it's
jerks.
Me. If you reach out to it, it's me.
It's Caitlin.
It's me.
All right.
If you got messages from Adam, I'll screenshot them and send them to him, and I'm sure he'll never reply.
Yeah. Yeah, probably not.
Probably not.
All right. Let's get out of here. Caitlin, say goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye, everybody. We love you.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. 2 420-foot vertical speedways, 3 launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed.
Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Emmy award-winning John Mulaney presents Everybody's in L.A., a special run of 6 live episodes created by and starring Mulaney that'll stream live on Netflix during the Netflix is a Joke Fest. The comically unconventional show will feature special guests where John Mulaney explores the city of Los Angeles during a week when every funny person is in it. Watch John Mulaney Presents Everybody's in L.A., debuting May 3rd live at 7 p.m. Pacific Time, only on Netflix.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun. And that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
When your space has the long-lasting, noticeable scent of Airwick Vibrant Scented Oils, it'll be the spot for everyone. From book club to game night, the kids can even host their friends.
Whoa, it smells amazing.
Airwick Vibrant Scented Oils are infused with 2 times more natural essential oils versus regular Airwick Scented Oils for our most authentic, nature-inspired fragrance experience. Hmm. Transform your space with scents like white sage and mahogany or lavender and water lily. Now that's a breath of fresh air, Wick.